The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
Several moments come to mind as candidates for the Race of My Life, but the most important race for me was in the Hesketh for the 1975 Dutch GP. My first GP win and the Hesketh team's only one. This alone made it very special because Hesketh Racing gave me and taught me everything in F1, and it was where my soul was. I have always felt that they deserved more than one GP win. Those are the words of the late 1976 Formula One world champion James Hunt, describing the significance of the 1975 Dutch GP, which he selected as his race of my life to Autosport in 1992. This pick is the latest in our Race of My Life mini-series. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor. And with me today, making his first appearance on this particular podcast, is Autosport Magazine's deputy editor, Marcus Simmons. How are you, Marcus?
Okay, thanks, Alex. Just working away at home and into quite a bit of a routine with that, really. And lots of interesting stuff going on. And nice to... I think it's a sign of my age, really, that you brought me in for something that happened in the 1970s.
No. Well, actually, I mean, as you were saying, before we hit the record buttons on our various devices, as we record remotely here, that obviously you were at quite a few of James Hunt's most famous races. So that's the real reason why he got you on, so I had to add some actual, you know, personality and memories from those events.
Yeah, I was a kid in the crowd, really. Going along with my dad, and actually we went to my first Formula One race was the International Trophy at Silverstone in 1974, and I was 7 years old then. And we'd really only been to a few club race meetings at Thruxton up to then, so I didn't know much about Formula One drivers. To me, the greatest racing driver was Jerry Marshall. That was my grounding, really, in the sport. And then I knew about Jackie Stewart and Emerson Fittipaldi and people like that, but James Hunt wasn't really a name that was massively on the radar. And obviously the Hesketh team was very small. And suddenly arrive at Silverstone and the whole crowd are going mad over this chap James Hunt in the Hesketh. And it was a dramatic race as well, because he got pole position by quite a long way, but then had a clutch problem at the start and got buried down in the field. It took a couple of laps to clear, at which point he charged through towards the front and passed Ronnie Peterson for the lead. Peterson was in the Lotus and passed him, I think, 12 or 13 laps from the finish, with an absolutely amazing dive into Woodcut Corner, which I didn't see because we were round at Maggots and Beckett's, which that in itself actually set the bit of a template for my future habits of watching around there.
That's where you always go and watch the races, I see.
Okay. Well, Maggots and Beckett's were very, very different in those days, but obviously the way the track has evolved since the in the last 10 years or so, that's definitely the place to go and watch racing cars at Silverstone. But it was a great day, and Silverstone was celebrating, and I thought, well, Formula One's pretty good as well.
Not the race we've come to discuss in the first part. We'll circle back to that, because obviously it's very important in Hunt's career to get his first F1 win with that non-championship race. And I'm always intrigued when we do these podcasts to understand the reasoning why the drivers have picked certain races. And a fair few of them are sort of, you know, they're not potentially their greatest performances, but they're the most significant races in their life. Now, with James Hunt, obviously one automatically thinks, mainly because of the film Rush, immortalized there with his battle with Niki Lauda, of the Japanese Grand Prix in 1976, which of course eventually he's crowned as world champion. But he's picked the 1975 Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort. Now, it's his third season racing in F1 with Hesketh, but he's had podiums. I think he's had finished second at Watkins Glen. He actually highlights this in the Race of My Life piece piece for Autosport in 1973, where he and Ronnie Peterson went clear of the field, but he couldn't find a way past. And it's sort of a bit of a theme of Hunt's early career, is that he just hasn't had that breakthrough win. It's almost that cliche that the first F1 win is the hardest one to get, and then they all seem to sort of fall ever so slightly afterwards. But what had happened in the 1975 season heading up to the Dutch Grand Prix and that breakthrough moment?
Yeah, well, taking it back a little further, actually. I mean, you mentioned the 73 Watkins Glen performance, and Hesketh in those days were running a privateer march, and Harvey Postlethwaite, who became the designer of the Hesketh, had made some modifications to the march, but Hunt was running up towards the front in quite a few Grand Prix that year, and the works car, which was being driven by Jean-Pierre Jarier that season, was right down the field, and the Watkins Glen performance was he was on Peterson's tail for much of that race, flinging this march around, and it was a proper giant killing performance. You know, if that happened today with a privateer team, a team running a privateer version of a car that actually isn't very good, then everyone would be going mad about it. Then obviously Hesketh constructed their own car for 74, but Hunt, you know, his nickname in his early days was Hunt the Shunt. And there were quite a few incidents during that 74 season. And the promise from the International Trophy had never really been built upon in the Grand Prix subsequently that year. So going into 75, he had a battle with Emerson Fittipaldi, who was the reigning world champion at McLaren in the first race in Argentina, and he made a mistake and finished second, but it was still a good result. And then things just hadn't really gone their way. There was particularly a race, the Monaco Grand Prix, which was affected by wet weather, and Hesketh made a right botch of the tyre change, and that was their chances gone. So they did a lot of tyre changing practice at the Hesketh base in Eastern Neston near Silverstone, going into the Dutch Grand Prix, which was quite handy because, as it would transpire, there were quite a few weather affected races that year. The Dutch Grand Prix was one of them. The British Grand Prix would be one a month later, which he also led, actually. He'd been kind of knocking on the door of a Grand Prix win, but it wasn't, you wouldn't necessarily have said it's ridiculous that James Hunt hasn't won a Grand Prix. The Zandvoort performance was a real breakthrough, and also it was helped a bit by the weather.
Yeah, it's always good, I think, when a driver picks a wet weather performance, because it's the great equaliser, is the other cliche that we like to throw about with things like that. But yeah, it's it did have quite an impact on the proceedings, the wet weather, is that right?
That's right. The race started on a fairly wet track, but it was drying out. I mean, Zandvoort is right up by the North Sea coast in Holland, and if you've ever been there, you'll know how windy it gets.
Sadly not. And then the pandemic took away my chance to finally visit it.
So suffice to say, anyway, that the track was drying quite quickly during the race, and of course, in those days, there weren't really people. Didn't have sector times or anything like that, so it was real seat of the pants tactics wise. No radios in the cars or anything like that, so the driver can't tell the team what the track's like in various places, but the crucial thing is that Hunt made an early he was competitive anyway. He was towards the front of the grid in dry qualifying, but the crucial thing was that he made an early pit stop to get onto slick tyres, and Niki Lauda, who'd been on a huge run of wins with Ferrari, and which pretty much set him up for the World Championship, came in a few laps later, as did most of the other leading contenders. The other driver to make an early call for a pit stop was Jean-Pierre Jarier in the shadow. Once the pit stops had shuffled out, Hunt found himself in the lead and Jarier was in second place. Which proved it was it was more Jarier's position that proved that the right thing to do was to make the early pit stop. But also, when you read accounts of that race, I mentioned before the Hesketh practicing with their wheel changes. When you read, they did a remarkable job and they were making pit stops in under half a minute. It seems a bit quaint compared to pit stops today, but that's how it was in those days. And they got him out very quickly for pit stops in that era, and he inherited the lead. Lauda was stuck behind Jarier for a long time, and that was pretty much crucial to Hunt eventually winning the race.
I mean, it's interesting you're talking about the pit stops there. I can remember watching that film. The person I was watching that film with, the Rush film, that is, I turned to them at one point and said, you know, they can do pit stops in 2 seconds now. She couldn't believe it, because 30 seconds sounds pretty reasonable for a pit stop, to be quite honest. But that's how different the world is today. But it's interesting, just going back to Hunt's words in his Race of My Life choice, he says, you know, he's like, he said he'd worked out what was, you know, because of obviously his experience in the wet that year, because of what had gone on in practice and things like that, that he knew that as soon as he thought, right, now it's time to come in for, or maybe now is just about the right time to come in for dry tires. He said that was already, it was already fine, because by the time you've come in, you've taken the 30 seconds to have your tires changed, everybody else is still out going around lifting up the water with their wet tires. But then you go out and it's almost not perfect conditions, but you know, acceptable. So that's what he did. He'd already planned it all out in his head when it came to making that crucial decision.
Yeah, and once he'd done that, as he mentioned in the interview at the time in 1992, he absolutely didn't make any mistakes. I mean, there's some good footage of that race, and as I said, Lauda getting stuck behind Jarier, who was defending second place for a long time, was quite crucial. He managed to eventually get past Jarier, who then very shortly afterwards dropped out of the race, but then. Cut the gap to Hunt, which you would have expected, because because Lauda and Ferrari were the dominant combination that year, and Lauda had also won at Zandvoort the year before, and from then on it was an absolutely brilliant performance by Hunt in the slower of the two cars. He doesn't put a wheel wrong. You can see on footage that the rear end of the Hesketh is flicking out on him coming out of corners, and Lauda looks so much more controlled, but he's absolutely not giving Lauda any opportunity to get past. And obviously the most important place at Zandvoort is the very the pit straight these days at Zandvoort is much shorter than it was in those days, because they had to truncate the circuit because a holiday park was built over part of it. So back then, the pit straight was much longer, but he managed to come out of the panorama. It's kind of like a chicane, but not how we would describe a chicane, more like a combination of two reasonably slow corners. And then through the final sweeping right-hander, and Lauda was never close enough to get ahead going into Tarzanbocht, the first corner. The other thing when you're watching that race, and this is a little hobby of mine really. Whenever I look at an old race or think about an old race, I like to have a list in my mind of top 10 Grand Prix that DRS would have ruined. and Zandvoort 1975 is definitely one of them, because Lauda so often was right up behind Hunt going over the start finish line, but the start finish line at Zandvoort, by then it's too late because you're coming down to the braking area for Tarzan, the first corner. And the other thing slightly related to that is that in 1975 and for quite a while after that, the back markers, when they were shown the blue flag, they didn't have to jump out of the way. The blue flags were there just to let them know that there was a car behind them. That was it. So on one occasion, you see Tom Price giving Hunt's gone past Tom Price, but Price then gives Lauda a massive chop going into Tarzan, and then keeps him behind for about half a lap before Lauda gets past. And then it evens out when Jochen Mass gives Balks Hunt, and he keeps Hunt behind for about three quarters of a lap. So and Tom Pryce and Jochen Mass by no means were they drivers with a reputation for being unhelpful or anything like that. That was just the way things were in those days, and the onus was very much on the quick drivers to find a way past, and that was really part of the tactics of racing in those days, and in Formula One especially, where these days you just expect the back markers to get out of the way instantly, and then you hear drivers moaning on the radio when they don't. Let's take away the blue flag rule that back markers have to jump out of the way, and then they can drop DRS, and we can have
yeah. Let's get overtaking back markers as the real overtaking aid. Yeah. I mean, I think there'd be a fair few supporters of that, to be honest. Hunt does hold on, obviously, and so let's hear from him. Obviously, just the end of his Race of My Life thoughts for Autosport, and then Marcus will come in, and first we'll have a little bit of analysis of how he managed to hold on and what that meant for him, and then go into perhaps some other major races in his life that he could have chosen. That was the completion of my training as an F1 driver. It enabled me to win the 1976 championship at my first and only chance in a competitive car under maximum pressure. Now, those are interesting words from Hunt, because obviously he's faced maximum pressure from Lauda in this very race that we're talking about. So Marcus, you know, do you think it was a combination of learning from his past mistakes and just putting it all together, and it led him on to greater things, almost again, and a cliche of, wow, I've finally made this breakthrough and I'm going to hold on and take me on to greater heights?
Yeah, so often when a driver takes their first win, that kind of releases the floodgates. And with Hunt, it probably wasn't going to be a floodgate of wins in the Hesketh, because as we've covered before, it wasn't a match for the Ferrari, and probably not for the McLaren either. So that would be, he'd go into the second half of, because this was about halfway through the season in 1975, so he would have gone into the second half of the year knowing that at least he could put in good drives to good point scoring positions. But then obviously the situation changed at the end of 75. Emerson Fittipaldi shocked everyone by leaving McLaren for his brother's Brazilian backed team, and suddenly one of the most desirable seats in Formula One was open, and Hunt really made the most of it. And I would imagine that Zandvoort win in 1975 was really crucial in him having the calmness to deal with anything that the races could throw at him. Although, having said that, he obviously was famous for not being very calm, because he used to be sick before races and was a bag of nerves. But what I mean is, when the adrenaline's flowing, you're not going to make mistakes. You're going to put in those performances where you're wheel perfect, and you can keep people like Lauda and also Jody Scheckter. A lot of Hunt's great performances in 76 were after battles with Jody Scheckter in the six-wheeled Tyrrell, which was going really strongly that year. So it obviously made a big difference, and he was able to put in those performances.
Absolutely. It's amazing what learning to deal with a bit of pressure can do in any walk of life, really, as long as you've got the skills to adapt to it and thrive with it. But Marcus, I mean, we've already mentioned the 1974 BRDC trophy win at Silverstone. You know, what other picks come to mind that you think James could have chosen for his Race of My Life? I think there's going to be some fairly famous ones from 1976. But yeah, what would you throw in immediately?
Well, I want to throw in a couple of 1976 races. Yeah, the one that I think is a really fantastic performance was the United States Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. We talked briefly about his 73 performance, and he obviously had a real affinity with that track, and 77 as well, which. It was a disappointing year by the standards of 76, but it was one of his three wins that season, and that was a great performance too. So he was usually really, really good at Watkins Glen. Fantastic circuit, just really like in the tradition of the American road courses, and the only real comparison we have in Europe is the modern Spa, really. Watkins Glen, great track, and also very prone to rain as well, like Spa. A battle with Jody Scheckter in the six-wheeled Tyrrell, and Hunt manages to he manages to get past Scheckter to take the lead when Scheckter gets balked while lapping a backmark. I mean, another illustration of how they used to affect races in those days. Scheckter managed to get back into the lead, and then Hunt repassed him and went on to take the victory. But that was the North American races then, because he also won the Canadian Grand Prix. So he won those two North American races going into the Japanese finale, where he clinched the championship. But they were especially crucial because he'd... Going into those two races, he'd been found out that he'd lost his win from the British Grand Prix in July, which had put him way back on Lauda in the World Championship. So, winning those two races, yeah, it was all or nothing, really. He had to do that, and the Canadian win was a really good one as well. I mean, he in that one, it was Patrick Depailler in the other six-wheeled Tyrrell who was putting him under pressure. So as we've already said, those are the sort of races that he might have lost, but in the days before he took his first Grand Prix win, because he would have made a mistake, but he dealt with the pressure in both of them really well, and got the win in both those events, and went to Japan for the final round just 3 points behind Lauda.
And obviously, everybody knows what happens there in the great downpour at Fuji. Lauda stops, not prepared to race on. Hunt carries on. The late puncture nearly costs him the title, but ends up third and does clinch the world title in 1976 for McLaren. But it's interesting. You mentioned the British Grand Prix, Marcus, because also his first win for McLaren in the Spanish Grand Prix at Yarama. It's what makes the 1976 season so, you know, I mean, there's so many compelling stories to it. There's obviously Lauda's accident. There's Hunt's breakthrough. Those famous on the line performances. And then the ultimate finale at Fuji. But it's the political off-the-track controversy as well is a fascinating subplot, because Hunt it was disqualified from the win in Spain before being reinstated. And then obviously there's the race at Brands Hatch, which he wins on the road and it has that taken away, but isn't allowed to keep him. But I think that's the one you really wanted to discuss on the podcast, the Brands Hatch event.
Yeah, the Brands Hatch run, British Grand Prix 1976, obviously has gone down into motorsport folklore, really. It was, without wishing to sound like an old fogey, it was the long, hot summer, the drought summer that everyone remembers. Elton John and Kiki D had just got to number one with the cheesy Don't Go Breaking My Heart, which seemed to be coming out of radios all summer. And everyone was getting excited about James Hunt, the British public were. And it seemed as though the whole of Brands Hatch was hyped up for a Hunt win, which actually I found, I was 9 years old by this time, and I found it a bit annoying because I'd become as a 7 year old in 74, I'd become a Niki Lauda fan because he was driving this brilliant sounding lovely red Ferrari, and then suddenly when all your friends at school start going on about James Hunt, you think, oh, where have you been the last few years when I've been a big motor racing fan and you've just said motor racing's a load of rubbish? So they were more into football, and fair enough, but it just illustrates how things had developed as far as James Hunt becoming a public figure. I think that nobody should remember that race, because it should be just a relatively dull footnote in history, because that race was stopped on the first lap for, in 1976 terms, absolutely no reason. we've talked about Watkins Glen, and I mentioned the Hunt against Scheckter battle there. Now, during that race, Jackie Ickx has a crash in his Ensign, and the car comes to rest in the middle of the track on fire, Ix injured both his legs, and he somehow manages to hobble across the track. Fire tender comes to the car. You've got the race going on under local yellow flags with a fire tender in a burning car in the middle of the track. Now, I'm not saying that's right, but that's just the way things were in 1976. The first corner of the British Grand Prix, Hunt got caught up with Clay Regazzoni's only spinning Ferrari, and he'd made contact with his teammate Niki Lauda at the first corner. And then Jacques Lafitte in the Ligier tried to go around the other side, around the front of Regazzoni, and he hit Regazzoni as well. So Hunt and Regazzoni managed to just about get the cars going and somehow get back to the pits. Lafitte's Ligier was the only car that was stranded, but that was off the track on the runoff area on the outside of paddock. So even today, that would be covered. You'd probably just call the safety car, and Hunt and Regazzoni would be out of the race. But the organisation of the British Grand Prix, had a reputation back then for being very bad. Don't forget, in 1974, Niki Lauda had a puncture late in the race at Brands Hatch and had come into the pits and then couldn't get out because the end of the pit lane was blocked. And somehow they just panicked, flew the red flags, even though there was no real reason for that, other than one car that was actually off the track and on the outside of paddock, and we got a restart, at which point all the arguments began. And it was an absolute eye-opener being in the crowd as a nine-year-old, where all the arguments were raging over whether Hunt would be allowed to take the restart. And this slightly jingoistic fervour that had enveloped Brands Hatch by this time was something that I'd never experienced before. And it was slow hand claps going around, lots of chanting. Not where we were on the south bank, between Graham Hill Bend and Surtees, but apparently there were a few bottles being thrown onto the track around the start finish area. So there was real sort of, it was really getting a bit more sinister than you would expect the nice genteel world of motorsport to be.
And how has it been conveyed to you? Was it coming across sort of the circuit PA, or was it just...
It was coming over the circuit PA, yeah. The developments were being broadcast to the public, and
they were sweltering. Enjoying their long hot summer with a few beers and getting a bit rowdy.
I know. Okay. The question was over whether he was going to be allowed to take the restart in the spare car, but of course McLaren, while all this arguing was going on, and the crowd were getting increasingly restless, they somehow managed to repair his original car, and he took up his place back on the grid. And then the race, it was Lauda leading, Hunt in second place, Lauda began to develop some gearbox problems, which meant that Hunt moved in for the kill and finally managed to make a pass on the just as they disappeared behind the trees up to the Druids hairpin, which is he should have done it a bit more in the in plain sight of everybody, but that was him. That was actually Hunt pulling off an absolutely superb maneuver, actually. He'd obviously worked out where Lauda was weak, where he was strong, and he did that move up to Druids, and as far as the race for the lead was over, that was it.
And then what was the reaction before all the arguing kicked off and all the legal things happened off track in the coming weeks and months? What was the reaction of the crowd once he'd secured that win for the time being?
It went absolutely mad. Brands Hatch were very clever with the way they scheduled their Grand Prix day back then. When you went to a Grand Prix at Silverstone, the support races used to there used to be support races after the Grand Prix, but at Brands Hatch the Grand Prix was the climax of the day, so there'd be no more racing. So everybody just was in a very jolly mood, and everybody was swarming all over the track, either on their way back to their campsite or on the way back to the car or just to celebrate. It was a real party atmosphere that was unforgettable, really. But you know, as far as the crowd were concerned, it seemed that the arguments had all taken place before the race. The fact that everybody had seen James Hunt win the race meant that, as far as we were concerned, that was final. He'd won the British Grand Prix. Niki Lauda had finished second. You didn't have instant news going on all the time or anything like that. So obviously the protests were beginning to come in, but the crowd just weren't aware of that at the time.
Absolutely. And then as you say, when all the legal wrangling shakes out and he loses that win, it sets up the phenomenal on the line. You know, the he's got a win to stay in contention races in North America at the end of the season. But yeah, any final suggestions that we could put forward for alternative picks for Hunt's Race of My Life?
Just a couple of others. I did mention Watkins Glen 77, which was a great drive. Managed to keep himself close behind Hans Stuck, who was the surprise leader of that race in the Alfa Romeo engined Brabham before Stuck made a mistake, although he was driving without a clutch, Stuck, so he sort of had that excuse for spinning off. But a couple of others, I would say the 1976 Dutch Grand Prix, so back at Zandvoort again, the year after he's taken his first Grand Prix win, and he was running in third place early on in that race behind Ronnie Peterson in the March and John Watson in the Penske. The March back then was it was basically their Formula 2 chassis, but with an F1 Cosworth engine in the back. So the brakes were never up to anything, and Peterson predictably faded. But early on, Watson tried to dive down the inside of Peterson into Tarzan, the first corner, but just a bit too ambitious, slid wide, and that put Hunt up to second place. Hunt then got into the lead ahead of Peterson, who then dropped down the order. So it was basically a battle between Hunt and Watson. Watson was just coming off his first Grand Prix win, which he'd taken at the Austrian Grand Prix a couple of weeks before. And again, it was a very similar situation to 75, but with Hunt in front this time and Watson challenging him, and again a race that DRS would have ruined. But Watson's only real opening was to try and go around the outside of Tarzan, which is slightly banked, and Hunt would make a habit of just washing the car up to the outside of the corner and leave Watson with nowhere to go, which was hard racing, but just about on the right side of fair. Of course, Mario Andretti tried that on Hunt the year after, and he was a bit more determined to cling on around the outside, and there was a predictable collision. But Watson was he knew Hunt better than Andretti did, obviously, and eventually he slowed with gearbox problems, but that was and Hunt won the race, but that was a great performance. The other one I would throw in is the Brazilian Grand Prix in 1977, where it wasn't a race Hunt won. He finished second after a pit stop to replace his front tyres, but that was a really charging performance on a very difficult track that was that claimed all but seven cars, and there were only seven finishers in that race. Hunt was ahead of Carlos Reutemann in the Ferrari until his front tyres went off. He had to go in and make a pit stop, and then he came back and finished, I think, only 10 seconds behind Reutemann. So that was a great performance. Would have made everyone think that he was had every chance of winning the championship again in 77, but then the season didn't quite go to plan.
All very worthy candidates for potential alternative choice. We've reached the point in the podcast where I have to make a frankly ridiculous, because who am I to judge anyone, especially someone as legendary as James Hunt in motorsport world, whether I would go for an alternative pick. But I'm going to stick with what Hunt chose, because I just think it was such a sensible and wonderful explanation of why that win in 1975 at Zandvoort meant so much to him, and what he then went on to achieve afterwards. I thought it was a really good example of a driver who was, as you said, Marcus, very fast, but very wild. The reputation that he had early on in his career, learning, putting it all together, and coming away with a breakthrough victory. So I think we'll stick with Hunt's Race of My Life being the 1975 Dutch Grand Prix. Well, I think we're going to have to bring this this very entertaining and informative podcast to an end. Marcus, thank you very much for coming on and joining us and sharing all your fabulous memories of the time.
That's okay. And actually, Alex, I'm going to agree with you. I'm going to say James Hunt was right and the 1975 Dutch Grand Prix was the race of his life.
Excellent. That's good to hear. Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, as I said, Marcus, for joining us. And thank you very much to you for listening. Now, do check out, you can read the full James Hunt Race of My Life interview, the feature that will be running on autosport.com. Do check out the full James Hunt Race of My Life choice on autosport.com, which will be running as a feature along with this podcast. So thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you again soon on another Race of My Life.
The Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Running a medical practice is complex, but you don't have to go it alone. When you join the Medical Group Management Association, you get access to an entire team of healthcare business experts, plus thousands of other members in practice management who face the same challenges as you. MGMA helps you advance in your career and helps your practice operate more efficiently and stay compliant. Learn more and join today at MGMA.com. That's MGMA.com.
At Care Heating and Cooling, we put you first. You are the reason we're open 7 days a week and why it's easy to schedule service at careheatingandcooling.com. Your safety is why we check every gas furnace for carbon monoxide. And it's because of you that our techs are paid to fix your furnace, not sell you a new one. So it's no surprise that last year Care was awarded a BBB Torch Award for ethics, because at Care, we're committed to doing business right. Call Care at 1-800-COOLING when you need a company you can trust.